Right. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, and welcome to our talk for today in our 2024 BIPs lecture series. Today's talk is Historiographical Controversies Involving the Rise of the Achaemenid Empire with Dr. Reza Zarghoumi. Dr. Zarghoumi is a practicing attorney, a partner in the international law firm of Pillsbury Winthrop Shaw Pittman, and a fellow in ancient history at the University of St. Andrews, where he obtained his PhD in 2022 for his thesis entitled Mythical Models, Reflections of Iranian Traditions in the Classical Accounts of Median Early Achaemenid Royalty. An adaptation of this dissertation is currently pending publication by the University of Edinburgh Press Studies in the Ancient Persian series, which is edited by Lloyd Llewellyn Jones. Previously, Dr. Zarghoumi authored Discovering Cyrus, 2013, which is a historical biography of Cyrus the Great. He's also authored articles that have been published or are in press regarding the leadership in ancient Persia, the religious aspects of Achaemenid royal ideology, the Iranian component to Xenophon's Cyropaedia, and the background to the legend of Rostam, the great hero of the Shahnameh. I am now going to close off my visual and my audio, and having introduced him, I'm going to let Dr. Zarghoumi take the floor. Reza, off you go, and thank you very much in advance.
Okay, so first of all, thank you very much for that kind introduction. It is an honor to give this presentation at BIPs. As stated, I obtained my PhD only recently, but the truth is that I've been reading about and studying ancient Iranian history all my life. And during the past few decades, there have been profound changes in the scholarship of the Median and Achaemenid periods. Today, I would like to address three such areas of change. These have to do with the characterization of the Medes and Median political power, the ethnic and cultural affiliations of Cyrus the Great, and the extent to which he had a dynastic affiliation with Darius I, also known as Darius the Great. There is a connectivity to these three topics, aside from each being germane to a better understanding of the circumstances surrounding the rise of the Achaemenid Empire. In each case, we have recent or relatively recent pushback against traditional views based on reinterpretations of longstanding evidence. And this is a key point I'd like to kind of hone in on. To put it a bit differently, I would say that with these topics, it is not so much an issue of being on the cutting edge of the discipline in terms of new texts being discovered, translated, and brought to light. I would characterize the work being done, say, on the Persepolis fortification tablets as falling into that category. Rather, what we're dealing with here is the privileging and transformation into mainstream ideas of arguments and theories that in cases always lurked in the background. And this is certainly the case with the second and the third topics that we'll be talking about, those having to do with Cyrus. So really at issue here are broader questions of methodology. What should be presumed? Who has the burden of evidence, if I may use the legal term? To what extent should we be reconciling different sources as opposed to dismissing some and focusing on others? And to what extent do we have a responsibility to present theories that defy straightforward interpretations of the source material as interesting possibilities, as opposed to advancing them as accepted doctrine? So with this in the way of preliminaries, I'd like to just jump in and turn to item one on our agenda, which has to do with the vicissitudes in modern scholarship regarding the characterizations of the Medes. Now, the Medes are and always have been a bit of a question mark in Iranian history. No state archives of theirs have been found. And nothing in terms of imperial style of art or architecture has been identified. In the absence of native documentation and primary sources of even a non-written form, quite frankly, opinions can shift. And that's what we're dealing with here. I'll begin with presenting, say, the older traditional view of the Medes, which has been superseded. And at the risk of being redundant, I'll pick up where an important 2003 volume entitled Continuity of Empires, edited by Robert Rollinger, Michael Roaf, and Mario Liverani left off. The epilogue to that work highlighted this. It's a map from a 1985 volume in the Cambridge History of Iran. It reflects the older modern understanding of the Medes in scholarship. It shows large portions of the Iranian plateau and lands as far off as Transoxiana near the Aral Sea, as being under direct Median rule or conquered by them. And it even shows the territory of Persis, this would be Persia or Fars, in the southwest as a dependent kingdom. This understanding of the scope and extent of Median rule is largely influenced by the Greco-Roman tradition, which featured the Medes in every which way as the imperial predecessors to the Persians, and as the masters of something teetering on a universal empire, given the understanding of the civilized world at the time. Herodotus is especially important here. His histories contains a fairly coherent, continuous narrative of Median history, referred to as the Medikos Logos. And it describes a unified Median kingdom founded around 700 BC that supposedly contained many institutions featured in the later Achaemenid Empire. This would include a centralized monarchy, the use of written records, the development of an intelligence agency, and later a standing army. This kingdom was supposedly governed by a single dynasty of four kings, starting with Deoces and ending with Astyages. The last of these rulers, and he was reputedly the grandfather of Cyrus the Great, who nevertheless rebelled against him and conquered him. Now, to be sure, Herodotus's narrative has some basis in history, as contemporary, or aspects of it do, I should say, as contemporary Near Eastern records, or at least we could call them non-classical sources, mention some of the names of the key characters and events alluded to by Herodotus. I've laid these out on this slide. You'll see it becomes, certainly with the identity of the kings, it becomes more certain when you get to Cyaxares and Astyages. And the kind of key events where there is correspondence include the overthrow of the Assyrian Empire, the Medes' role in that, the wars waged between the Medes and Lydians, and Astyages being the ruler whom the Persians conquered. Now, there is also a significant disconnect, however, between the Medikos Logos and the cuneiform record, especially concerning, as I said, the earlier portions of Herodotus's narrative. First and foremost, I would say the dynastic relationship between the four Median kings is never explicated in the cuneiform sources. Although this may be a function of the fragmentary and discontinuous nature of these documents. But really the major point is that the cuneiform sources do not so much as hint at a unified Media until we get to the records that describe the fall of the Assyrian Empire in 616, 609 BCE. And in fact, Assyrian texts from just a few decades before this talk about there being many minor rulers of the Medes. They use the term Belalani. Now, beginning in the 1980s, a number of papers picked up on this discrepancy, emphasized these points of disagreement to set the stage for marginalizing the Medes in Iranian historiography. The principal works were by Peyton Helm and Helene Sanchisi-Weirenberg. Sanchisi-Weirenberg in particular cut the core of the issue with a paper entitled, Was There Ever a Median Empire? And as you can imagine from the title, it questioned the very existence of a Median state and even hinted that the Medes might have been nothing more than a loosely aggregated group of nomadic tribes. The fundamental theme of her paper, and I understand it may not have been well received at the time of its publication, but certainly it was picked up about a decade later in a 2001 conference in Padua, Italy. With a couple exceptions, the papers comprising the volume on the conference, it's actually where I got that idea of starting with the map earlier, called into the question the existence of a functional Median state. As a general proposition, the authors dismissed the notion of the Medes as the Persians' cultural and imperial predecessors. One paper went so far as to suggest that the Median period witnessed a breakdown in government and a backslide toward nomadic pastoralism. Others argued that the Median state was at most a loose confederation of rulers who could be unified on an ephemeral basis, short-term basis for long-term raids. These papers were impactful, and you see the impact that they had on the scholarly perception of the Medes by looking at the two juxtaposed characterizations of the Medes on this slide. One, J.M. Cook's quote epitomizes the older view, and then you have Adriano Rossi basically captures the prevailing modern view, or perhaps even an extreme statement of it, which basically calls into question the imperial system and structure and the Medes' legacy. Now, I definitely do not want to say that these recent observations are lacking in merit. And in fact, the state of the evidence is such that some, if not many of them, may well be true, especially the bit about Median rule taking on the structure of a confederacy. To touch upon a point that I'll get to in a moment, I would note that the Medes were, after all, you know, if you had to divide the Iranian plateau into north and south, they're part of the north. And throughout Iranian history, royal rule has tended to be less centralized when groups from northern and especially northeastern Iran, which was a continuum of the steppe, were politically ascendant. I would say it's instructive to think of, say, the Parthian Empire and how it consisted of 16 or 17 sub-kingdoms on the eve of the Sassanids' rebellion. On the other hand, I would also say that no one would deny that a Parthian state existed or that they should be glossed over in Iranian studies, even if their empire was not as centralized or functional as the later Sassanid state. Now, I do feel that some of the positions that have been taken regarding the Medes are dichotomous. And I've provided on this slide some indications in the Near Eastern sources which could be interpreted to suggest that at least under Saiksaris and Astyages, the Medes may have acquired enough cohesion to become formidable and to set up something that at least was regarded from the outside as a state. And I would say that, in fact, a lot of the problems with the Medikos Logos and in the traditional view of the Medes and how we adapted to the lack of evidence, they may go away if we consider that Herodotus simply erred in presenting the Medes as politically unified from the get-go. I have my own ideas as to how this may have happened. It is true that the information is modest in terms of quantity. However, we also have to bear in mind, I think, the brevity of the Median period, at least the period of supposed imperial rule or potential imperial rule from the time of Cyaxares to Cyrus the Great's conquest. It lasted only 60 years from about 612 BC to 550 BC. And this is a very short period within the long durée of Iranian history. Moreover, the fact is that the main Median royal center of Ecbatana has not yet been scientifically excavated as it lies buried under portions of present-day Hamadan. Now, to be sure, the past decade or so has seen, and this is kind of the theme of this first topic I want to talk about, is how the pendulum may swing. It has seen some indications that opinions regarding the Medes may go the other way, at least towards something less minimalistic. We can start with what we see in some of the recent publications, that there's an admission that by 550 BC, certainly, there must have been a unified Median polity that exercised control at minimum over the central Zagros. In about the last decade and a half, Stefan Deschamps and Hilary Gopnik have drawn attention to possible Median architectural influence during the period following the fall of the Assyrian Empire at a site called Erebuni in the former territory of Urartu, which would later become Armenia, a region that various sources characterize as having been conquered by the Medes in the early 6th century BC, and even further west of that at present-day Altintepe, Turkey. Now, there's not an imperial style to point to, but what we're talking about here is the spread of older pre-imperial styles and techniques and architecture. But what is really interesting to me is that in 2021, fairly recently, the document shown here was discovered at Hasankeyf in Turkey. It is a record of an Assyrian real estate transaction containing an unprecedented dating formula referencing the tenure of a cupbearer. These things were normally set up to reference, they outline the terms of the contract. There's some oaths and, you know, curses on those who might break it. And then they tend to be dated to the reign of a king. This one is dated referencing the tenure of a cupbearer. And as Michael Roth has shown, there's reference also made to a certain Obakishtar, the Median king. And this is none other than Cyaxares, the reputed conqueror of Assyria. Now, this is just one document. You don't want to overstate it. But the implication, at least to me, is that portions of the Assyrian homeland were not just raided by the Medes, but were under some form of Median hegemony, stable hegemony, whereby the local administration operated under the auspices of Median overlordship. And this, in fact, was the common view of what happened in northern Mesopotamia after the Median, after the fall of the Assyrian Empire, before the paradigm shift regarding the Medes in recent decades. Now, where the consensus on all this will land, whether the pendulum will in fact swing back toward a more kind of moderate view of the needs, I don't know. I have a feeling that, especially in light of the Hassan Kaif inscription, we may get to a place where the Medes are deemed to have had some form of stable state structure over their homeland and some nearby territories, leading up to and following their conquest of Assyria, and that their rule was probably less secure or perhaps even non-existent in certain regions that previously have been characterized as being under their firm dominion, if you think about that map that I showed on the first slide. And this would be an improvement over early modern scholarship before the nature of Median rule was questioned. But the point I wish to make is that we could have probably arrived at this understanding, if that is indeed where we will end up, more directly had we taken a synthetic approach to the sources from the outset. And here I'd like to draw attention to this important, but I think often overlooked passage by Herodotus. In his overview of Persian customs, the father of history provides a slight digression on Median political structure that fits very well with the current state of the Near Eastern evidence, I think, by which I mean primarily texts inscribed during the period 616 to 522 BC, texts largely that, of course, were inscribed in Babylonia, not within Iran itself, with the inscription of the exception of the Bisutun inscription. And basically, the quote begins by saying, "Of nations, the Persians honor most their nearest neighbors, whom they esteem next to themselves. Those who live beyond these, they honor in the second degree," and so forth. And then Herodotus goes on to say that this is similar to the way that the Medes ruled their empire. Under the dominion of the Medes, the several nations of the empire exercised authority over each other in this order. The Medes were lords over all and governed the nations upon their borders, who in their turn governed the states beyond, who likewise bore rule over the nations which adjoined on them. This passage provides, I think, a viable framework for synthesizing the tradition of the Medes as a quote unquote imperial power with some of the productive observations that have been made in the discourse of past decades, such as the multiplicity of Median kings referenced in the Book of Jeremiah and the Sippar cylinder of Nabonidus, as well as the treatment in Mesopotamian texts of Cyrus II and his ancestors as kings of Anshan, despite Greek statements that the Persians were Median vassals. So speaking of the Persians, let's move on to the second agenda item. And this has to do with the subject of the cultural affiliations of Cyrus II. In classical literature, Cyrus is spoken of as the Persian. The Greeks tell of his liberation of the Persian homeland, of how the Persian aristocracy referred to him as the father, and how he was the subject of quasi-legendary tales that cast him in the role of an epic hero. His Persianness became front and center in the 20th century. I should say his Persianness, perhaps his Iranianness would be a better term. This is when Mohammad Reza Shah exalted Cyrus and, according to Bibbs's own Alianz, he sponsored a cult of Cyrus the Great as part of his own program of nationalization. However, certain strands of recent scholarship present a totally different view of Cyrus. It has become increasingly vogue, it seems to me, to portray Cyrus as an Elamite, the Elamites being the pre-Iranian population of southwestern Iran and what's today Khuzestan, or a Persian king culturally oriented toward Elam. This is all supposed to be in contradistinction to Darius, who is sometimes portrayed as the first truly Iranian ruler of the imperial period. Now, I feel the need to preface my discussion of this discourse by saying that issues of culture and ethnicity are always a bit controversial and sensitive, even as I found out when you're talking about matters of several thousand years ago. And I'll be the first to admit that according to genetic analysis, most Iranians today are the descendants of the pre-Iranian substrate population. The quote unquote Iranian element itself entered the plateau evidently in relatively small groups who nevertheless managed to introduce a new and persistent cultural identity. As is always the case, it is not as though preceding practices were stamped out. Rather, there were both breaks and continuities. But there can be no doubt that in the long haul, Iranian identity became more prominent than that of the groups that were there before, at least within the settled regions of the plateau in the period of antiquity. What remains unsettled, of course, is when this tipping point occurred. Now, the first image that I'd like to flash here is this one. All the Achaemenid specialists, I assume, will be familiar with it. It is a line drawing of a seal impression on a Persepolis fortification tablet called PFS 93. The seal bears an Elamite inscription that reads, Kurash the Anshanite, the son of Sheshbesh. There's some debate on this, as there is with nearly all Achaemenid artifacts, it seems, but most scholars tend to agree that the Kurash in question is none other than Cyrus I, the grandfather and eponym of Cyrus the Great. Now, he's described here as an Anshanite, and for those that do not know, Anshan was the age-old Elamite word for the area roughly synonymous with the highlands of present-day Fars. With the influx of Iranian groups that self-identified as Persians, the same region came to be known as Parsa or Persis, Persia, and it may well be that the bearer of this steel is the same individual as the Kurash king of Parsuash, Persia, who paid tribute to Ashurbanipal between 646 BC and 640 BC, about 100 years, 90 years, a little bit less than that, from the time that Cyrus achieved his first major conquest. Now, how might we explain the phenomenon of the same individual being styled the king of Persia and Anshan in different texts? Well, if we suppose, and it makes good sense to do so, that the old Persian cuneiform script was either non-existent or at least in a novel experimental stage when this seal was engraved, we have a ready explanation for the use of the Elamite toponym in the seal impression. In the absence of an Iranian writing system or tradition, the default was to Elamite. Indeed, Elamite continued to be the main bureaucratic language and script in Fars well into the imperial period. So it is hardly surprising that it would have been used during the pre-imperial period. And since the inscription on the seal is in Elamite, there should be nothing ironic either about the fact that the toponym itself was also rendered using the age-old Elamite term. For this reason, I tend to give this artifact, which is often brought to bear in the discourse about Cyrus's cultural affiliations, I tend to give it marginal weight, let's just say. Now, the situation becomes more interesting when we get to the text from Cyrus II's own reign. The arguments regarding his Elamite heritage are in fact largely fixated on two points, his titulary and his name, and that is the order in which we'll get to them in this talk. Regarding the issue of titulary, we turn our attention first to the one substantive lengthy inscription that can be firmly attributed to this king, and that is the Cyrus Cylinder. This text, and it's very important to understand this, was inscribed in Babylonian and intended for a Babylonian audience. In it, Cyrus refers to himself and each of his named lineal ancestors as great king, king of the city of Anshan. We do not see any reference in this inscription to the term Parsu or Persia. With one exception, much the same holds true for all the other epigraphical material contemporaneous with his reign or that draws on texts that were composed during his reign. Now, and I've given an example of one here, the Nabonidus Chronicle. Now, given that Cyrus was a world conqueror who in theory had maximum leverage to style himself however he pleased, much has been made of his apparent use of Anshanite titulary. Several scholars have framed it as indicative of a sort of aspiration to the cultural mantle of Elam, or when taken together with the onomastic evidence that we'll discuss next, as an indication of this ruler's Elamite heritage. Bolstering this view is the fact that Darius the Great abandoned Anshanite titulary entirely. Rather, he referred to himself proudly as a Persian and an Iranian or Aryan. The problem with the interpretations, I think, that would read too much into Cyrus's Anshanite titulary is that they do not account for the literary genre of the pertinent texts or of broader developments in the literature of the royal inscriptions. Regarding the first point, it bears emphasis, I think, that all the Babylonian inscriptions that style Cyrus as a king of Anshan adhere more or less to the Mesopotamian priestly scribal tradition. A hallmark of this tradition is that it employs archaic terminology in reference to geographical locations and ethnic groups. A modern analogy might be to think of a writing that doesn't use an English writing that doesn't refer to France as France, but calls it Gaul. This is relevant because Anshan was a well-known geographical term in learned Babylonian circles since the late 3rd millennium BC. Moreover, and this is key, Anshan is not the only anachronistic toponym or ethnonym used in the relevant inscriptions concerning Cyrus. For example, the same text, and here I will cite the Cyrus Cylinder, referred to the city of Babylon as Shuana, to the land of Media or its borderlands as Gutium, and to the Medes themselves as the Oman Manda, literally the hordes from who knows where. Now, it is exceedingly unlikely that the latter two appellations, Gutium and Oman Manda, were terms that the Western Iranians applied to themselves, for they had pejorative connotations. In Mesopotamian tradition, Gutium was this daunting, mountainous land of terrors, and the Oman Manda were like Gog and Magog, a destructive horde, sometimes described even as half-human. Now, as far as I know, none of these archaic terms appears in the inscriptions of Darius the Great or his successors. Rather, these texts on the whole strive for more accurate renderings of Iranian toponyms and ethnonyms, even in the Babylonian versions. So what I think we have to contend with is not an evolving literary tradition. It's not so much an issue of cultural predilection and affinity or a cultural divide between Cyrus and Darius, but rather of an evolving literary tradition. Under Cyrus, who presided over the more nascent stages of the imperial period, the deference, especially in Babylonia, to Mesopotamian literary practices was greater. By Darius's time, a new standard was established that on the whole sought to accurately employ the native nomenclature of Iranian lands and peoples. So I think it teeters on being a little bit selective to focus just on the use of the title King of Anshan. To cut to the chase, it doesn't take into account the broader literary setting of these inscriptions. Now, I have a similar sentiment regarding the other linchpin of the Elamite theory, which concerns the etymology of Cyrus's name. I will spare you all the nuances of the philological sparring, except to point out that the key detail that advocates of an Elamite background have cited is the manner in which Cyrus's name is rendered in Elamite and Old Persian. It is always Kurash in Elamite and Kurosh in Old Persian. And I'm taking liberties with the pronunciations here, as we'll get to. The critical feature being that as between the two renderings, Elamite, this is important, could tolerate either a form Kurash or Kurosh, whereas Old Persian could only have Kurosh. Thus, the fact that the Elamite is always in Kurash suggests that this was the original and that Kurosh reflects an assimilation to Old Persian. It is also important to note that Kurash lends itself to a ready Elamite etymology, meaning something along the lines of he who bestows splendor or care. At a glance, therefore, I think this seems like a slam dunk. I will say there's a picture of F.C. Andreas, who's the first, about 120 years ago, is the first scholar to really advocate for an Elamite background to Cyrus's name. But I'll say that, you know, at a glance, I think this is a very compelling argument. Now, one might say off the top, as Walter Henkelmann did in a 2008 article, that the origin of a name does not necessarily shed light on one's ethnic ties. And this is true. It is especially true if we subscribe to the theory that the Persians had begun to immigrate into the highlands of Fars in the mid-second millennium BC, so basically 1,000 years before the rise of the Achaemenid Empire. In that case, I mean, you have every reason to expect that there would have been a thoroughly mixed population with distinctions between Iranians and Elamites breaking down. On the other hand, I think the textual evidence, especially if you see the references to the Persians in Assyrian inscriptions, are such that we can't preclude a much more recent arrival, perhaps as recent as the 7th century BC, so about 150 years before Cyrus. And if so, the distinctions, though I would say they were still breaking down, would have likely existed to a greater degree. So for more than just rhetorical purposes, I think it's worthwhile to consider how the Elamite theory holds up under close scrutiny. So in this regard, I think it is significant that although Kurash lends itself to an Elamite etymology, there is, to my knowledge, and if there are any Elamite specialists in attendance, I'd like to get their thoughts in the chat. There is, to my knowledge, no attestation of the name in the Elamite onomasticon that clearly relates to someone other than one who might be also deemed a Persian. There's a much earlier attestation of a form Qurashu in Ur 3 period text, but no indication is given that the bearer of the name was an Elamite. So I do not deem that occurrence as dispositive. We should also note that words are often transliterated imprecisely. Old Persian may have been particularly susceptible to this, given that it was scarce on vowels, and that some of the vowels, including specifically the short A and short U, may have sounded close enough to be conflated. There's also the possibility of folk etymology, whereby a foreign name is assimilated to another name or concept in the receiving language. We have examples of this from the Achaemenid period, involving Persian names being translated into Greek and other Near Eastern languages. The best example of a Persian name that was assimilated through folk etymology to in a Near Eastern context involves the individual depicted here. This is Darius I's trusty spearbearer, Gobryas the Patascorian. His name was erroneously, but perhaps with some intent, rendered in Babylonian as Kabare in the great king's Nakshirostam inscription, which evidences assimilation to the Babylonian word for the exalted one. It's always rendered differently in other contexts. Now, to be sure, several plausible Iranian etymologies exist for the name of Cyrus. There is no scholarly consensus about which one is correct, but the lack of a consensus does not mean that the general premise of an Iranian origin is wrong. What I ultimately deem decisive, though, is that in Indian literature, Puro appears as an ethnic name of a most likely Iranian group that lived to the northwest of present-day India. This was the same general location that housed another ethnic group, the Kambojas, who were clearly Iranian. They're actually pretty well attested in different Sanskrit texts with some linguistic and cultural glosses. And I think there's just an obvious etymological relationship between these names and those of Cyrus, Kurosh, as well as of his father and son, both of whom were named Kambujir, Greek Cambyses. Now, as the period before the rise of the Achaemenids and the Medes was one of tribal migrations from Central Asia to the Iranian plateau, I believe that there is much to the theory or speculation, really, espoused by Arnold Toynbee, that steppes of these tribes may have moved from east to west, where they merged with the Persians and left their imprint on the names of these kings. And as indirect support for this proposition, I would point to Herodotus's list of the 10 Persian tribes. And this may have derived from a source prior to 515 BC, but at least three of the names seem to correspond to those of peoples or groups otherwise attested in Eastern Iran or the borderlands of India. India, the Panthiali, their name sounds roughly similar to Panchala, but you have the Dayans are like the Dahai of Central Asia, and the Dropikans like the Derbases, who also live to the east of the Caspian Sea. I would further note that when you're talking about making arguments regarding ethnicity and cultural predilection, I think a broad view is appropriate. And I think it's notable that all the bearers of the name Quraysh, attested in texts from the 7th and 6th centuries BC, had children with Iranian names, not with Elamite names. This holds true for our Cyrus, who even named his eldest daughter Atossa, this being a very hallowed name in the Zoroastrian tradition. And there's additional evidence we can get into in the Q&A that supports, I think, the traditional view that Cyrus regarded himself fundamentally, at least, as a Persian. Now, you can ask, what did that mean at that time? And that's a little bit of an open question. Could he have had an Elamite bloodline or have been fond of the Elamites? Sure. But I think the totality of the evidence does not dictate this conclusion. And, you know, if you bear in mind what I mentioned about the Kuros and the Kambojas, I think one might also straight-facedly mount an argument going the other way to suggest that Cyrus's name suggests even an uber-Iranian heritage, in as much as it came from the East, which at that time was closer to the original heartland of the Iranians. And I would also note, by the way, religious considerations, you got to take this into account as well. If you're talking about a cultural divide with Cyrus and Darius, FireAltar and Stepped platform at Pasar God. Cyrus's capital looks an awful lot like the space of the instruments of worship that you see on the tombs of Darius and his successors. So with that said, let's get to the last topic that I would like to address, and it pertains to the dynastic ties or lack thereof potentially between Cyrus and Darius. The discourse on this topic, in my opinion, very much highlights the need for recognized methodology in Achaemenid studies, primarily on the issue of what is appropriate to presume and what should be presented as possible alternative interpretations of the evidence. Here, there's an interesting dynamic because whereas, for example, with the Medes, we didn't have a lot of source material, here we do have sources, but the tendency is to deconstruct them to the point of setting them aside. Now, the traditional view is that Cyrus was an Achaemenid. Inscriptions at Pasar God, his capital, describe him as such, and he's explicitly described as a descendant of Achaemenes by Herodotus. Increasingly, however, it is vogue to speak of two separate dynasties, a Tiaspid one that included Cyrus and an Achaemenid one started up by Darius. And the belief underlying this is that Darius came to power in a violent coup, this is a fact, less than a decade after Cyrus's death. But the belief is that he effectively falsified the record to make Cyrus a member of his own Achaemenid dynasty, and that what we see at Pasar God and in Herodotus merely reflects Darius's propaganda. Now, there's no explicit proof that the circumstances of Darius's coup d'etat are false. This is important to bear in mind. I mean, they do sound, it's an interesting tale, and basically what it says is that Cyrus had two sons, Cambyses II, who was his successor, and a younger prince named Bardiye. Cambyses killed Bardiye before conquering Egypt, but kept the assassination secret. Then, during Cambyses' prolonged stay in North Africa, a Magian, a member of the Median priestly caste named Gomata, seized power by declaring himself to be the dead Bardiye. Cambyses died on the way back, but Darius slew Gomata in a fortress in Media and made himself king. The story is a real page turner, as I said. I've been waiting for the Game of Thrones people to rip it off for one of their spin-offs. But many scholars have deemed the notion of a royal imposter patently false. And they prefer to believe that Darius concocted the story to cover up his assassination of the real Bardiye. Moreover, the progression of logic is that if Darius could lie about whom he killed to become king, he was also liable to legitimate his rule by lying about his ties to Cyrus, with whom he supposedly the adherents of this view say had no affiliation. Now, Michael Rove recently published an article urging scholars to pump the brakes here, that even if Darius lied about who he killed, we have no firm basis to presume that he fabricated his or Cyrus's family background. I'd like to build off his observations by presenting just a few items for your consideration. First of all, the idea that the false Bardiye, as he's called, must be bogus is, I think, a knee-jerk reaction. Royal imposters were more common in antiquity than we might think. If we just look at Roman history from the period of the late Republic and early Principate, you get eight examples, high-profile imposters who pretended to be dead princes or political leaders. And notably, you'll see that the list includes no less than three false Neros. So I think if we want to adhere to methodology here that gives some degree of deference to the existing sources, as opposed to proceeding based on our own intuitions, I think it is fair to state that although Darius's story may sound suspicious and may be false, we're not in a position to dismiss it out of hand. And this means that we should think twice before assuming that Darius lied about his connections to Cyrus. Now, the proponents of a two-dynasty theory are not basing everything on Darius's veracity. There are, to be sure, nuances of the source materials that make them susceptible to interpretation, pursuant to a two-dynasty model. We can start with the long-form lineages of Cyrus and Darius as given in the Cylinder inscription and at B. Sutun. As you can see, Cyrus carries his lineage up to a certain Thyspes, whereas Darius goes back one further generation to Achaemenes. Now, if we focus on this point alone, the situation is anomalous, and we have to ask ourselves why Cyrus did not go up one more generation himself. But the fact is that the issue of naming ancestors is not the only detail in these texts. What you'll see is that Cyrus calls each of his named ancestors a king of Anshan, whereas Darius states only that some of his ancestors, he's not specific as to who, were kings, as were members of his extended family, ostensibly including Cyrus and Cambyses. The theory that has been floated in recent years is that Darius manipulated his genealogy to make Thyspes, the founder of Cyrus's line, a son of Achaemenes, the eponym of his own clan, and that this accomplished the dual purpose of connecting himself to Cyrus while subordinating the Thyspids to his own family. This all sounds very devious. But if one does not wish to interpret these discrepancies as evidence of a fraud, the easy reconciliation is that Cyrus only went up to Thyspes because he was the first ruler in the bloodline, or at least the first to rule in Anshan. Rove points this out in his paper. I would like to add a few points. First, as I stated, the Cyrus cylinder evinces Cyrus's strong desire to come across as a normative Babylonian ruler. And in the Mesopotamian tradition, a king had to be born of a king. And in fact, rulers whose fathers did not hold the kingship, and we know of two during the Neo-Babylonian period, Nabopolassar and Nabunaid, conceded that they were a son of a nobody. So you could see why Cyrus had this, you know, imperative to only go after the first king in his ancestry. That is, in fact, what Thyspes was. And I think there's a modicum of evidence, a bit controversial, to suggest that even after Darius's accession, the Achaemenids did in fact regard Thyspes as the first king in their bloodline. And this evidence comes from two tablets, and this is where the controversy sets in, that are generally regarded as having been commissioned during the late Achaemenid period. And these are in the names of Arsams, the grandfather, and Ariaramnes, the great-grandfather of Darius. And just look at how these two texts portray Thyspes as opposed to Achaemenes. Now, I don't want to stress this evidence too much because some have deemed these inscriptions to be not just antiquarian forgeries, but modern forgeries. But if the majority view of them as 4th century BCE inscriptions commissioned by the Achaemenid royal family holds, I think they provide a really important key for understanding the early history of the dynasty. They certainly don't seem in line with the notion that Darius perpetuated a new family history that sought to subordinate Thyspes to Achaemenes. Now, the last point I would like to address here are the inscriptions at Pasargad that call Cyrus an Achaemenid. They are short, almost caption-like. There are two basic texts. You could read them on this slide. And for many years, they were taken at face value. However, they are now largely regarded as having been commissioned by Darius. This notion goes back to a series of articles by Biff's own David Stronach, who excavated Pasargad in the 1960s. He was, as everyone knows, an excellent scholar of ancient Iran, whose contributions to the advancement of Iranian studies, particularly in the realms of archaeology and architectural history, are invaluable. But I think on this point, it's important to understand the background of his work because it serves as the foundation. And it was intended as a rebuttal of Carl Nylander's joint authorship theory that held that the relevant texts were in toto commissioned by both Cyrus and Darius, meaning that we would have in the record inscriptions of Cyrus styling himself as an Achaemenid. And for the purposes of completeness, I would just note that Nylander's joint authorship theory was in turn a reaction to earlier views advocated by the likes of Walter Hinz, who interpreted section 70 of the Elamite version of the Bisutun inscriptions as provided that Darius had invented Old Persian cuneiform. This interpretation of Bisutun seems to be falling by the wayside, though I think it's interesting that this has not resulted necessarily in a reevaluation of the line of scholarship that flowed from it. But basically, the fundamental thesis of Nylander's work was that the Babylonian and Elamite versions of some, but not necessarily all the Pasargad inscriptions must date to Cyrus's reign. And these would be inscriptions that refer to him as an Achaemenid. And Stronach's paper was a counter to this, essentially presenting an archaeological case to support Hinz's theory of sole authorship. So let's take a look at how these two eminent scholars addressed each of the CMC and CMA inscriptions. We could start with CMC. Stronach argued that the inscription must date to Darius's reign because it appears on the hem of a robe that is carved in the so-called Achaemenid court style. And the defining feature is the robe's folds. This style appears in slightly more mature form in seals commissioned at the time of Darius, but also at Persepolis. And so on art historical grounds, Stronach suggested that this inscription describing Cyrus as a great king and an Achaemenid must have been commissioned by Darius. It may well be, but we have to admit that this argument is not entirely bulletproof. We have very little from before Darius's time to compare the depiction of robes to, and Margaret Coolroot and Henry Colburn for example, have suggested that Achaemenid royal art may have developed in non-linear ways based on their analysis of the different artistic genres present in seal impressions. And then there are epigraphical considerations that actually point to this inscription preceding Darius. I don't want to get too much into the details. You could read it here. But basically, the idea is that there are nuances of the text that are consistent more so with Neo-Elamite texts than with Achaemenid texts. And this shows that they predate, there's a case to be made that they predate the Bisutun inscription. So I would say that the argument Stronach mounted regarding CMC is at best questionable. Now, if we move to CMA, you know, there were approximately 20, possibly as many as 30 copies of this text that were set up throughout different palaces at Pasargad. Here, you know, we're dealing with trilingual versions. And it's important to note that the CMA text basically appears in two styles. One has the each version, the Old Persian, the Elamite, and the Akkadian, is just bracketed, but not squared off. You see that in the image above the carving of the four-winged guardian here. In the other, it's bracketed and then it's unified with vertical lines. And, you know, I call that here type two. Now, the type one inscription appears at buildings known as Gate R and Palace S, both of which were completed by Cyrus. Type two found in Palace P. This was a structure that Cyrus started, but Darius completed. Now, according to Nylander, Nylander basically says that there's reason to believe all of these, the Elamite and Babylonian versions of them, all were carved by Cyrus, but he feels much more strongly about the type one inscriptions. And he seems almost willing to concede that Darius may have been the author of the type two text you see at Palace Feet. Well, what's interesting here is that Stronach's rebuttal focuses only on the type two inscriptions. In other words, the ones that Nylander was willing to concede. Regarding the type one inscriptions, Stronach, in my opinion, and with all due respect to this very excellent scholar who was personally kind to me, tiptoed around it. And he explains the discrepancy in terms of Darius being in such great haste to perpetuate his dynastic fraud that his artists rushed the work and forgot to close off the bracket. Now, this is very subjective. Now, to button up the hatches in a catch-all sense, Stronach goes on to say that there's a well-known principle of Achaemenid architecture that inscriptions were added only after a building was constructed in its entirety and surfaces polished. I'm not certain that this was the case. And so basically the idea is that because Darius completed the building, that he would have put all the inscriptions onto the stone. But I'm not sure that this well-established principle in fact holds, because at Persepolis, there's a palace called the Tachara. And we have there, it was founded by Darius I, completed by his son and successor Xerxes. And we have on that palace, we have inscriptions by both Darius and Xerxes, which suggests what I think is the more probable scenario. And that is that portions of the building were likely completed sequentially with the inscriptions put on as they were going. Now, I would therefore suggest on the strength of all this that Stronach's paper, which is foundational to the widespread belief that Darius and not Cyrus commissioned all the Pasargad inscriptions, portraying Cyrus as an Achaemenid, is at best equivocal in terms of the case that it seeks to make, if it does not altogether fall short. I could go on about my own ideas as to why the very premise of Darius rewriting history in this manner is unlikely, but for purposes of time, we could save that for the Q&A, which unfortunately will have to be short. But in the way of a concluding remark, I would like merely to state that we've looked at three areas of ancient Iranian or Achaemenid historiography where paradigms have changed drastically in recent years. I fully recognize the need to constantly revisit the evidence and to consider things from different vantage points. I recognize even that doing so has been productive overall in each of these terms, in terms of honing or fine-tuning positions. At the same time, I do believe that we should be a bit on guard regarding drastic reinterpretations, especially in cases where the overall corpus of evidence has not really changed, and that we should also be wary of privileging alternative interpretations. This is particularly true when it comes to Darius. They may be true, right? We have no way of proving it. And we have to be wary, I think, of privileging those alternative interpretations, presenting them as doctrinal over straightforward treatments of the sources. I think the best way to do this is to take a synthetic view of the sources and to triangulate the evidence, looking for ways to reconcile inconsistencies as opposed to citing them as grounds for dismissing a given tradition altogether. This, of course, is easier said than done. And I'm not saying that I'm above the fray myself, but I do believe that it is the best path forward in the study of ancient Iran, where sources are, after all, limited, diverse, and patchy. Thank you for your time.
That's great, Reza. Thank you very, very much for a fascinating dissection, a detailed dissection of the issues to hand. So I'll take one question that I've got here from someone. What do the acronyms CMA and CMC stand for? What's their origin?
Yeah, so Pasargad, which is the capital of Cyrus, it's in the Dasht-e Murghab, the plain of Murghab. So CMA means Cyrus Murghab inscription A. And CMC, Cyrus Murghab inscription C. There was a CMB inscription, but that one almost certainly it was very speculative. It was put together based on fragments, and it's best to set that aside. It doesn't really advance the ball, or it's not really germane to this.
Okay, thank you very much. I have one person, a second question, saying thank you so much. Not a question, a statement. Thank you so much for such an illuminating and deep discussion. Are you acquainted with Abdullah Sudavar's, sorry, the screen is shifting, linkage of Parsa with the same word in NP, New Persia, meaning, sorry, the screen is shifting again with questions.
Yeah,
meaning wise holy man,
priest,
and
yeah.
Speculates that Darius's lineage was priestly and distinct from Cyrus.
Yeah, I don't, with all due respect to Mr. Sudavar, I've talked to him about this. I don't subscribe to that. In part because you also, you also have determinatives in some of the non-Old Persian cuneiform scripts. And so they make very clear, like, when reference is being made to a geographical entity or whatnot. With all due respect, I don't attach much weight to it.
Okay, thank you. Fantastic present. Oh, there's the screen shifting. Sorry. Fantastic presentation. What about Cyrus's wife and her heritage? Her father seems to have been Persian.
Yeah. So Cyrus's wife. Now it depends which one. And according to the sources, it's possible that he had. I would venture that he probably had multiple wives. But his main wife, according to Herodotus, is Kasandane. She is supposed to be the daughter of a certain Pharnas, who is described as an Achaemenid. Now, I'll mention this. There is a theory that Cyrus was an attempt at reconciliation, that Cyrus was Elamite, Darius was Achaemenid. Cyrus married an Achaemenid princess, and Darius latched onto that fact to characterize Cyrus as an Achaemenid, right? So it was basically Achaemenid through marriage. I don't accept that, because in ancient Iran, the notion of the family and the clan affiliation was paternal, right? Through paternal inheritance, not just through as a paternal legacy, not so much through marriage. And the proof of it for the Achaemenid period is this. I showed you a picture of Gobryas, the Patiscorian, the spear bearer of Darius. This individual and his son Mardonius, who's the famous general of Xerxes, I believe the family connection is this. Gobryas's daughter married Darius. Darius's sister married Gobryas. Mardonius, his son, who then marries Darius's daughter. Okay. There is basically what you're dealing with are two families that are interconnected in multiple ways. Gobryas in the Near Eastern sources is constantly referred to by his clan, his own paternal clan name, which is Patishovaresh or Patiscorian. It's the same term that appears in, you know, later sources as Patishvar. It means the land, you know, next to the sunny side of, you know, the mountain, or land to the east, or something like that. So if this issue of being an Achaemenid through marriage were to hold up, I think you would see it stated. You would expect Gobryas or Mardonius to also be termed Achaemenids, and they are not in any source, including the Greeks. And Mardonius's reference, Mardonius in particular, gets a lot of play in Greek sources.
Okay, another comment saying thank you very much for the presentation. Question: What is the evidence in the academic literature at present on Cyrus' affiliation with Zoroastrianism?
Yeah, so I think, you know, with Cyrus, I mean, there's very little evidence, period. But I think you have to take you have to take kind of you know, it's a cumulative. You have to look at the evidence cumulatively, and I think this is where you have to start. And what I'm saying is specific to the Achaemenids. I don't want to get into the issue of popular religion. You have in the Platonic Alcibiades, the first Alcibiades, you have a clear and distinct reference to the Persian crown prince being indoctrinated into, this is about 4th century BC, into the Magia, basically the mysteries of Zoroaster. You then have to look at the iconographical evidence, trace it up. The later Achaemenids, who the Greeks knew to be Zoroastrian, their tomb carvings, which have a religious scene, I flashed it there in the image showing the fire altar, that's the same. You could take that all the way up to Darius. You could take that, then you have the actual physical fire altar and stepped platform at Pasargadae. So that shows there's some continuity between Darius and Cyrus. Then you have to look at the onomastic evidence. And onomastic evidence in ancient Iranian studies is very important because of the dearth of other evidence. Oh, by the way, I should say that Darius and Xerxes, the stuff in their inscriptions is very consistent, I mean, with Zoroastrianism. It's certainly not, they don't declare themselves Zoroastrians, but then again, neither do the Sassanids, right? So you build this cumulative case, but then you look at the names, and the name he picked for his eldest daughter, Atossa, Hutotha, this is the equivalent to the Avestan Hutosa. This is the wife of Kavivishtas, who is in Zoroastrian tradition, the royal patron of Zoroaster, the one whose patronage kind of kickstarts Zoroaster's career. Now, again, it's not the best evidence, but there's not a whole lot there. And I would say that I think as it pertains to the royal family, at least, you know, I think the burden is on those that would look to discount their Zoroastrianism and dismiss it. And I think this holds true for Cyrus as well.
What about Cyrus's death? Whom do we believe, Herodotus or Xenophon?
Yeah, interesting question. I get into what I think is the oral traditional substructure of this at depth in my thesis and in the book that will come of it. I think you have to go with her. Well, you know, both of them are heavily infused with, you know, legend and folklore. On the general premise that Cyrus died in battle, I believe that Herodotus is correct. You get the same story told a couple centuries later, less than a century later, by Ctesias, who was a physician at the court of Artaxerxes II. A couple centuries after that, you have a learned, you have Berossus, who evidently had access to Mesopotamian records. And he says that his understanding from these archives is that Cyrus fell in battle in the plain of the Dahai, which is the area, the steppe to the east of the Caspian Sea. Xenophon says that Cyrus, you know, died peacefully. My guess is that's an idealization, because, you know, Cyrus in the Cyropaedia is the ideal king, and the violent death is unbefitting of him. But I'm not entirely convinced that Xenophon made that up himself. It would not surprise me. And one of the things that, you know, in the book I have forthcoming is that Cyrus's life was highly mythologized within a few generations of his death in oral traditions. And it would not surprise me if there was adherence to a pre-existing pattern, a tale of an epic hero who dies peacefully, and that there was an assimilation of that. And that's the tradition that Xenophon happened to pick up, not the one Herodotus did. I will say this with Herodotus, the fabulous story of the queen of the Massagetae beheading Cyrus and dunking his head into a bowl, or, you know, skin full of blood and whatnot. There's a great Rubin painting of that. I think that's, you know, that's all embellishment, perhaps, you know, inspired by Dionysiac or traditions. Alexander, when he entered Cyrus's tomb a couple centuries later, actually saw the body encased in wax, and there's no indication that the head was missing at that time. So his body was recovered.
Okay, I did say I was going to close it, so I'm not going to take any more questions, but I want to thank Reza Zaghami very, very much for a really interesting talk. I have to say, this is not my particular field of interest, but I understood what you were trying to say and understood the criticisms you were trying to make, and I look forward to the publication of the dissertation. Reza, once again, thank you very, very much, and to all participants, thank you for your time, and I wish everybody a good morning or good afternoon or good evening from wherever you are. Thank you very much.
Thank you all. Bye.